With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, the Bureau of Reclamation increases the Central Valley Project water allocations. We'll have more on that. But our top story today, the Risk Management Agency's recent rounds of feedback gathering has resulted in improvements to coverage and information access regarding two specialized policies for specialty crops and small-sized farmers. Rod Bain reports.
Over the past 2 years, USDA's Risk Management Agency has conducted education for small-sized farmers and specialty crop producers on two specific crop insurance products tailored to their operation.
Full Farm Revenue.
And
the Micro Farm.
Risk Management Agency Administrator Marcia Bunger describes how these policies work, starting with Whole Farm Revenue Protection.
WFRP provides a risk management safety net for all commodities on the farm under one insurance policy. What's been more traditional is that policies have covered a single crop. This is the whole farm.
While micro farm policies resemble whole farm revenue coverage, however,
that particular policy is even less paperwork intensive, and it's tailored for small operations, those specialty crops, those farmside stands that are growing vegetables, fruits, that kind of thing.
Among the feedback that the RMA administrator and others within the federal crop insurance system have received over the past 2 years from eligible producers pertain to their local crop insurance agent and their connection to whole farm revenue protection and micro farm policies.
The feedback then we got is, well, where do I find one of these agents?
RMA has an agent locator service available at their website, www.rma.usda.gov. And based on the feedback,
we've updated that agent locator site with a new searchable directory to help those individuals looking for a whole farm, micro farm specialty agent, somebody that has been selling, is experienced, knowledgeable about this particular product.
The administrator notes RMA conducted mapping to better understand the degree of crop insurance agents providing whole farm revenue protection.
And what we learned is that when agents responded with that, yeah, I would like to be identified as being a WFRP whole farm agent, we do have availability for agents to sell and service policies in all 50 states. The number, I think, right now is at a little over 1,100 agents across the country that self-identified.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
An expert says wild bee populations are stressed, but there's progress made on providing good habitat. Gary Crawford reports.
If this wild bumblebee that I recorded on my front porch here could speak to us, it might be saying,
we need habitat, we need to be protected, they need nutrition all through the year. We need lots and lots of different kinds of flowers. Lots of different pollinators need different ones.
And it might also tell us that we need it. This according to Dr. Cass Urban-Mead. She's an expert with the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. And a while back, I had a chance to talk with her in Washington out at the Agriculture Department's People's Garden. She says our food supply depends on plant pollination, which is done by bees and many other insects.
At least one in three of our bites of food relies on pollinators to some degree, and that's particularly true once you zoom in on your most nutritious and nutrient-dense foods, the nuts and fruits and vegetables, and then lots of other important crops and wild plants are highly dependent on pollinators.
And she says it's not just honeybees that do this work. In fact,
we actually have over 4,000 species of wild native bees who are not honeybees living. Many of them are solitary. Some of them are shiny and green or blue or your carpenter bee, your bumblebee, all of these beloved native pollinators.
But as you've probably heard, conditions may not be the greatest for some of these bees and other pollinators.
There's multiple stressors that are making life more difficult for a lot of our pollinators.
She says a changing climate isn't helping any, but the overall problem is basically the loss of natural habitat, as more wild space is being lost to development, and in many cases, the wrong kind of development.
Making things monoculture lawns, spraying everything with insecticides maybe prophylactically rather than carefully as a response to a specific problem.
However, as much as we've talked about this here and the problems, Cass says no matter what you've heard,
there's absolutely progress being made
as more people become aware of the problem.
It's exciting to see more insects being considered in endangered species and protection laws. It's also just exciting to see how much the public and so many more people are really caring and asking for pollinator habitat to be included in a new park design, in their schools, in their towns.
And in their own home lawns and gardens.
There's no space that's too small. You can make a difference no matter how small your space is. It's not, you know, a polar bear or a great wolf that needs huge numbers of acres, no matter whether you just have a small patio, a balcony, a patch of grass nearby, you can convert it into habitat and start to make that difference.
And next time, we're going to find out exactly what we homeowners or property owners can do to help out my friend here on my front porch. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Cindy Zimmerman has today's National Spotlight.
I'm here at the Ace Lion, and I'm with Bill Kauser, my friend from Iowa, who's a cattle producer and an ethanol plant investor, and also a member of the EPA Farm, Ranch, and Rural Communities Advisory Committee, and something he's been on before and been on for a while. So, Bill, tell us about that committee and your involvement in it.
Yeah, they reenacted it about 6 years ago, and they put out to the United States, they wanted people to put in their application and kind of a broad base across the country of livestock producers and different academia. And out of 560 applications, I was very blessed to be one of the 30 to become on and be able to represent the farming community, the ethanol community, agriculture, basically. And what our job is to do is we basically get three or four challenges every year from the administrator. And our job is to come together with a white paper. Is how can EPA improve their methods of reaching out to rural America, to the cities of America, whether it's wastewater, whether it's manure issues, whether it's methane, and how do we make sure that the administration hears from grassroots?
Well, you've worked with several different EPA administrators. What do you think about our current administrator?
Well, as I stated in the meeting here, we had the privilege of hosting Regan and Vilsack the first week on the job here 3.5 years ago in our shop. And like I stated, it's the first time I've seen in my career of 30 or 40 years coming in here of those two gentlemen from different offices in the same room at the same time, because we would always get their staff. And to see the relationship now that EPA and USDA have and can sit down together, not their staff, but the two leaders, and come to an agreement where everybody can work through some of the issues and policies that we've got going on. And then to be part of the farming community or the agriculture community and bring a recommendation to both of those gentlemen, because, you know, I know them both personally. It means something, and they've always got someone they can call.
Well, you also spend a lot of time here up in D.C. You're here for the ACE D.C. Fly-In. You're here almost every year, as far as I know, and you also come up here with other groups. So just tell me about your experience this year and some of the meetings that you had and how they went.
Well, you know, I can honestly say I've been doing this for 30 years, and in the last 10 years, we finally have a seat at the table. You know, as a livestock producer, when I put on my cattle cap, you know, the EPA was a bad word. I mean, we would never let them in. And another gentleman, Dave Petty from Iowa, and I decided 20 years ago we were going to change that relationship. So now we've cultivated it to where we have those positions. I have three appointments in EPA now, and we've actually held meetings in the National Cattlemen's Office with EPA, which you would have never heard of 10 years ago. So we feel very strongly that we've cultivated a relationship because they're part of our team now, and we can't forget that. Whether you're ethanol, whether you're agriculture, whatever it is, they're part of your team because it's part of the policy, it's part of the rulemaking, and as a feedlot operator, I have an NPDES permit. So I have rules and regulations I have to follow, And the reason I'm so adamant, I think I'm in here every month for the next 7 months to do something with EPA or USDA, is I want to make sure that my sons, or our sons and daughters, can farm in the future with policy they can survive with.
Well, as far as the issues facing the ethanol industry right now, year-round E15, getting the GREET model right for SAF, those kinds of things, that's what we talked about on the Hill this week. What do you think the chances are that any of that is going to get done in this presidential election year?
Well, I don't know if we'll see it done in this presidential election year. I think everyone, when you go to the Hill, it's a different mindset today. And it's challenging, but we heard positive messages from the D's and from both sides of the aisle. And they all want to get it done. They want to get a farm bill done. They want to get E15. But it's going a little bit slower, I think, on the EPA side, because they want to make sure that this is done right and they get sued less. You know, I think that's one of the challenges, because everybody's not afraid to sue today. And so if it does take us another year, it might have to be. But we're going to continue to say, let's get it signed, because we got to do it eventually. We've smoothed all the rough edges over for whether, you know, on our Hill visits, whether Democrat or Republican. Everybody's in agreement, because if you're involved in climate or believe in climate, we're part of the solution.
All right. Thanks very much. Bill Kauser here in Washington, D.C. with the ACE Fly-In. I'm Cindy Zimmerman.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's John Harith with the Livestock Report.
USDA Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs Alexis Taylor is in Seoul leading a trade mission to South Korea with representatives from 48 U.S. agribusinesses and farm organizations and five State Departments of Agriculture. U.S. Meat Export Federation Vice President of Asia Pacific Jihae Young joined the Undersecretary to highlight the success of U.S. red meat in Korean retail.
The USDA Undersecretary Alexis Taylor and the other delegation members visited the key retail chain, including E-Mart Traders and the Lotte Mart and other wet market in Korea, to take a first-hand look at how the U.S. food items are being sold in Korean retail the store. And USMEF could successfully showcase the U.S. beef and pork, and the USMEF has taken advantage of her presence to highlight the importance of the U.S. beef in the Korea market, taking advantage of the Korea-U.S. free trade agreement. Currently, U.S. beef is subject to 5.3% tariff, while the Australia, our biggest competitor in the market, is still subject to 10.6%.
USDA staff have been key in building strong consumer confidence in U.S. beef and pork.
The USDA FAS Korea staff are always supportive for the U.S. beef trade and the pork trade, and they also witnessed how well the U.S. beef and pork sales, especially to observe the consumer confidence, as we are always concerning about the consumer confidence toward the U.S. beef since BSE. They also witnessed and they shared their observation how the U.S. beef and pork are well received by the Korean consumer.
For more, please visit usmef.org. For the U.S. Meat Export Federation, I'm John Harith.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report. But first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director Brian German.
Noble Research Institute and Ranch Management Consultants have partnered to offer financial management courses for U.S. farmers and ranchers. The collaboration grants Noble access to RMC's Ranching for Profit program content. The first Noble product benefiting from the relationship, Noble Business Essentials, is scheduled to launch in June. It's aimed at enhancing participants' financial literacy and profitability. Noble's focus on land stewardship and soil health aligns with RMC's expertise in agriculture business training. The program will help farmers and ranchers evaluate their financial situation, calculate income potential, and plan for positive net farm income. The partnership extends the reach of RMC's economic tools and curriculum to new audiences. Additionally, RMC offers ranching for profit schools and intensive workshops to educate agriculturalists on improving land health and business profitability. Canada and Mexico both raise concerns about USDA's product of the USA labeling rule. Mexico's Ministry of Economy is rejecting the rule for meat, poultry, and eggs, arguing it discriminates against Mexican producers and could disrupt binational production chains. The rule stipulates that these products must be exclusively raised, slaughtered, and processed in the United States to bear the label. The ministry contends that the measure may lead to food chain disruptions and increased costs for both Mexican producers and U.S. consumers. Additionally, the ministry criticizes the rule for its inconsistency with U.S. obligations to the World Trade Organization and the USMCA. Canadian officials share similar concerns, expressing disappointment and vowing to raise the issue during trilateral meetings with the U.S. and Mexico. Despite opposition, the USDA maintains that the rule, which is voluntary, protects consumers from misleading claims. The Bureau of Reclamation has increased water supply allocations in the Central Valley Project. After a slow start to the new year, February storms helped improve California's water supply conditions. Allocations for North of Delta contractors have been increased from 75% to 100% of their contract total. South of Delta contractors also saw modest increases, with irrigation water service and repayment contractors to receive 35%, while municipal and industrial contractors will receive 75%. For Fryant Division contractors, Class 1 water supplies increased by 5% from last month to a total of 65%, and Class 2 remains at 0%. The Westlands Water District expressed disappointment with the lackluster increase in allocations, with General Manager Allison Febo noting that from what they see, the science regarding operational decisions and the hydrology moving forward support a higher allocation. The California Certified Organic Farmers Foundation is offering grant opportunities to vocational and higher education students that are pursuing degrees or certificates in organic agriculture. The grants will be awarded to help students pay for tuition and other educational expenses. Applications for the $5,000 grants are being accepted now and will need to be submitted on or before April 19th. Postgraduate degrees are not eligible for these particular grants, but prior grantees are welcome to reapply. An applicant's financial need is considered as part of the grant decision process. In the last 8 years, the CCOF Foundation and their partners have provided more than $800,000 in grant support to students and teachers to help further their education. More information about the grant opportunities is available at ccof.org within the Future Organic Farmers page of the CCOF Foundation tab. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
The Senate passed a resolution last week to block beef from Paraguay. Now industry leaders are looking to the House. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The National Cattlemen's Beef Association is calling on the House to follow the Senate's lead and pass a resolution against the import of beef from Paraguay, a country that, until now, USDA has blocked from beef imports because it must vaccinate for foot and mouth disease. NCBA Vice President of Government Affairs, Ethan Lane.
You know, when you have anything coming from those areas of the world that have had those issues, whether it be foot and mouth disease, BSE, or whatever else to the United States, we in the industry here take an extremely sharp eye to any kind of discussion about a trade relationship in the beef supply chain with those countries.
Lane does make the point clear that while it's a regulatory issue for the beef industry, consumers do not need to worry about the safety of the meat. We go now for this segment to Chuck Zimmerman.
At Commodity Classic, I'm visiting with Justin Welch with GHX. And we want to talk about your app, the GHX mobile app, and I know there's something new there, so let's start right there.
Sure. It's great to see you again. You know, a year ago when we visited, we were on version 1.0. We had just launched GHX as a route to market for Golden Harvest, getting to visit with farmers, talking about growing better crops. And the app is all based around that same thing, is how do we help farmers grow a better crop?
So tell me a little bit about maybe just a little overview of what it does for your customer.
From a holistic view, we look at trying to help farmers maximize revenue, minimize risks. So inside of the app, we've got grain markets down to the local level so they can see basis and future contracts and call their elevator and see all that information about how do they raise their revenue from grain markets and then also from yield estimations. So in the app, they can go in and see what their yields are in season, how it's trending over the year. So if there's risks, they'll know maybe they don't want to market so much grain. And then on the risk side, in season, we work with our farmers on finding those pests, finding those issues that we try to resolve or at least make them aware going into harvest. What we find in ag is it's a big portion of our customers have a partner, a seller, an agronomist, someone that they work with. Many of our customers like seeing the information. They don't always like doing the entry of that information. And so we take care of a lot of that for them. So we'll map their field boundaries. We walk a lot of their fields. We send them crop health reports. And they like receiving that. Not everyone wants to create that on their own.
That information, though, helps both sides here.
Our goal is to keep them in business. You know, we want farmers to stay in business. We want their kids to farm their land. You know, hopefully someday their kids grow up wanting to plant Golden Harvest, you know. So if we can keep them in business by helping them raise their yields and revenue, then that's going to be good for everyone. And that's what our advisors focus on, is how do we help bring that to farmers. Not every farmer is going to use digital services. It's probably about 50% of the growers we work with are interested in the app themselves. But about 90% of them want to see the information out of the app. And so that's why we assign seed advisors and agronomists to every customer.
So how do they get the app? What kind of platforms does it work on?
Yep. So it's on the Google Play Store. It's also on the Apple Store. As normal, you can download it today. When you do, there's a place that says Guest Access. Go to Guest Access. You can put your name in there, and we'll set you up an account and send you an email. Or you can just go to Guest Access and look around if you want.
So for the farmers that are coming here to your booth at this Commodity Classic where we are, what's the most important thing you want them to know?
That if they want to grow a bigger crop, come talk to me. That's our biggest goal, is how do we help them grow a bigger crop? And my job in digital could be in giving them a software platform that allows for them to do it, or at least making sure our advisors and agronomists are providing them information to do that.
Well, thank you very much, Justin, for visiting with me here. We're at the 2024 Commodity Classic. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
Pivot Bio's sustainability program has already paid millions of dollars to farmers. Michael Klimitz has more.
Pivot Bio, a sustainable agriculture company empowering farmers to change their nitrogen management practices, announced that its sustainability program, Innovator, has paid over $6 million to farmers for implementing better nitrogen management practices since its launch in 2022. Pivot Bio's head of commercial sustainability, Randy Minton, explains why the program is gaining popularity with farmers and companies looking to reduce their environmental footprint.
Through the Innovator program, we can help transform how the ag community really thinks about nitrogen. Pivot Bio's Innovator program provides a streamlined platform for validating nitrogen replacement with a more predictable and productive form of nitrogen, and provides a mechanism connecting our growers with companies looking to reduce their emissions.
This year, companies participating in Innovator made payments to reward Pivot Bio farmers for their practice change following the 2023 harvest. The largest transaction to date was the sale of 100,000 nitrogen credits to a global food and beverage company.
The size and scope of Innovator's partnerships represent a major shift in how companies invest in sustainable agriculture. Our program provides a prompt and annual payment to farmers and is actually the first sustainability program to focus on nitrous oxide emissions in agriculture.
Participating farmers receive revenue for the sustainability benefits generated on their farms as a result of using Proven 40, microbial nitrogen that can replace up to 250% of a farmer's total synthetic nitrogen use.
Farmers can earn a higher return on investment on their purchase of Pivot Bio products by replacing a portion of their synthetic nitrogen with Proven 40 and participating in the Innovator program. Pivot Bio's microbial nitrogen is really a game changer in establishing a more sustainable food system. It's better for farmers and better for our environment. Our goal with Innovator is to establish a low-risk program that supports and compensates farmers who adopt new nitrogen management practices. Farmers can better protect their land and environment while creating a new reliable revenue stream.
Pivot Bio anticipates making additional payments to farmers to round out the 2023 program. It is actively enrolling interested farmers in the 2024 program. For more information on Pivot Bio and how to participate in the Innovator program, please visit pivotbio.com. Michael Klimitz reporting.
Those Easter eggs may be fun to decorate and nice to look at, but think twice before you eat those eggs. Gary Crawford has more.
Okay, guys, you said you had the perfect song to kick off our story today on Easter eggs, right?
Yeah!
Okay, go for it.
Easter bunnies, we are
hold
Easter bunnies.
Stop! I'm sorry, we're doing a story on eggs, not bunnies. So do you have an egg song?
Yeah!
Okay, go for it.
Easter bunnies.
No, no, never mind. Thank you. Yes, bunnies are bountiful this time of year, but for this report, it's eggs and egg safety. We've got with us Meredith Carruthers, a food safety expert, dispenser of food safety knowledge at the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Meat and Poultry Hotline. So, Meredith, I thought we had a great egg song to kick off our story today, but alas, it didn't work out that way.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes, but we will doggedly forge ahead.
Yay.
Yay, okay. Now, we know, Meredith, at the hotline around Thanksgiving, you get mostly calls about turkeys and that sort of thing. But at this time of year, what are most people asking about?
We're starting to delve more into the egg world.
The egg world, ooh. And of course, at this time of year, many families are planning on following that age-old tradition of coloring or decorating eggs, maybe having a little family Easter egg hunt. But you've got some words of caution about that if we intend to eat those eggs later on. It's got to do with controlling bacteria that can be on or in those eggs. So first, Meredith, you want us to wash our hands before we start the coloring or dyeing process on those eggs. Why is that?
Because eggs can technically have salmonella on the shell, not just inside the egg.
And it could end up on our hands when we're working with those eggs, or vice versa, already be on our hands and then be put back onto the eggs from us. So I guess we need to wash hands before and after decorating those eggs.
Yep, before and after.
Okay, so after cooking those eggs, you'd think, though, they'd be totally devoid of any harmful bacteria and that the shell would keep the bacteria out of the egg, but wrong. You say it's still vulnerable to bacteria. Why is that?
The shell itself is actually very porous. Things can pass through it.
And you've told us before, bacteria can multiply to sickening levels within just a couple of hours at room temperature. So those eggs should go immediately into the fridge. And if they have been out for more than a couple of hours, we should not try to eat those eggs, which brings us to... Ah, yes, the traditional egg hunt. What about that?
Oftentimes, you're putting them outside. There's different bacteria and things that are present outdoors. So just not knowing what they potentially have touched or come in contact with, it's better just to not eat them.
Okay.
Does that help answer all your eggy questions?
Yes, it was excellent. But if we do have more questions on any food safety subject, we can call the Meat and Poultry Hotline, 1-888-MP-HOTLINE, 1-888-MP-HOTLINE, or for live chat, go online and go to ask.usda.gov. Thanks again, Meredith.
You're very welcome. I hope you have a great day.
I'll go out of my way to have it.
Oh, wonderful.
Okay, this is... Oh, no, not again. No, this is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Why me?
This is the AgNet NewsHour, and we will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. Brian German has this week's almond update.
This week's almond update from the Almond Board of California highlights a segment from the Almond Journey podcast featuring Almond Board of Australia CEO Tim Jackson. Podcast host Tim Hamrich had an opportunity to speak with Jackson at the Almond Conference back in December about some of the issues they've been dealing with in Australia as it relates to the Carpophilus beetle.
And while we're talking, you know, pest management, I definitely want to talk about this Carpophilus beetle that I understand you all have seen in Australia for around 10 years or so. Is that true?
It just come from nowhere. We know that Carpophilus, they're just like in California, talking to stone fruit growers. While I've been here, Carpophilus, there's different strains of Carpophilus, and there's always been a Carpophilus in different industries. But it's always been perceived that it attacks fleshy fresh fruit. And 10 years ago, we found this new variety of Carpophilus on our orchard. It grows in the ground or lives in the ground, and it attacked our crop. And life's never been the same since.
And you don't know where it came from? Or?
No, we're still stumped as to where it actually arrived. So it's not something that's been there forever. It just came from nowhere. The beauty of growing, Tim. Every year is a different challenge. Some live with us longer than others, and certainly Carpophilus had a huge impact on it. They are a ravenous beast, and I've seen Carpophilus beetle in a bin of almonds straight out of the hull and shallow when we didn't know what was going on. That turned it into a bin of meal in no time. So they just destroy the product.
Yikes. And I understand, similar to native orange worm, they overwinter in mummy nuts?
Yes, correct. So orchard hygiene is the number one preventative measure. Not cheap, but it's still perceived as the number one preventative measure around getting on top of Carpophilus beetle in your orchard.
Okay, yeah.
I suppose when it arrived, it very similar conditions to what you've experienced this year. We had a really wet season. It was almost identical type of climatic conditions that brought the Carpophilus out in the first place.
Huh. That's interesting. I wonder if that's correlation or causation there, but that is certainly interesting.
And the ongoing challenge is that when you go through tough years like we're going at the moment is if you've got to spend extra money poling, taking mummies out of trees, out of every tree and every orchard, that's an expense. And if you're really on the edge of actually making a dollar, it's an expense that some people just can't afford. But the challenge with that is if you don't get rid of them, then your problem becomes your neighbor's problem as well.
And is this something that hole split sprays can help with as well, or not in this case?
No. So it's very hard to get rid of. It seems to have been more prolific in the wetter, more humid conditions, but it's certainly something that comes to life just before harvest. When the hole split does happen, that's when the Capophilus finds its way in. And predominantly, we find that the Capophilus is far more attracted to nonpareil because of the softer shell than the harder shell. So most of the damage is appearing in our premium product. But it's an ongoing battle.
Yeah. And I had read that there's a chance Carpophilus has been in the U.S. for a few years now, but maybe we were mistaking the damage for another pest. Does it look a lot like damage from other pests?
It certainly does. It's probably the biggest difference between Carpophilus and the others is not the drill. The drill hole that was being mentioned in different presentations we've had over the last couple of days is the same. But the difference with Carpophilus is that if you get a lot, it lets off a fair old smell. So if you've got Carpophilus in your almonds, you can ship them off and then you can have someone at the other end coming back saying there's a pretty stinky smell in your almonds. Yeah, so it's a significant issue.
Yeah. And through improved sanitation in Australia, have you been able to minimize the damage or suppress the damage, or is it still something you're looking for new ways to manage?
As soon as we found it, straight on to trying to research. And so we spent a lot of research on it, thinking that it was a different type of Carpophilus. And it was only after a certain amount of time we discovered that it was actually peculiar to almonds, that it wasn't some of the more common ones that are used, that are seen in stone fruit. So that sort of set us back a little bit because we thought we were dealing with one thing and it was another. So developing a pheromone that actually attracted the right one was set back a little way. But under the research from Ag Victoria and through David Madge, who's been on this for nearly 10 years now, we think we're on the right track. But a bit like orange navel worm here, by no means are we well and truly past the winning post and getting on top of it.
Yeah. And so do you all not have to deal with navel orange worm in Australia?
No. Carpophilus is our orange navel worm. Carob moth is our other major pest.
But Tim, like you mentioned earlier, it's also something where, as an industry, you know, it benefits everybody for the sanitation to happen properly.
Sure. The other issue with Carpophilus that I'd advise is that once you've got it, that it's not only a grower problem. If hullers and shellers are taking in product with Carpophilus, then there's a cleaning issue. You do not want a bin of Carpophilus-infested almonds in a warehouse. So you need to be very strict around your transferring of the product and when you fumigate. The sooner you can fumigate after hulling and shelling, the better off you're going to be and isolating that product. In my previous life, it was one of the first things that we noticed is that you don't want to jeopardize a lot of product that's clean by having something come into your warehouse that's potentially not, because it's not only an orchard pest, it becomes a storage pest as well.
That's a really good point. Well, you mentioned something earlier about, you know, Richard's collaboration over the years and in contribution to the global industry. I'm curious about the collaboration between the Almond Board of California and the Almond Board of Australia and how that helps kind of grow the pie for everybody.
Yeah, for sure. So over the last 3 days, a lot of the problems and a lot of the challenges, whether it's in marketing or in R&D, are very similar. So a rising tide lifts all boats. So certainly happy to collaborate wherever possible. We understand that there's some competitive tension and some real unease around where the market is at the moment with pricing. But from our point of view, a healthier Californian industry with a good price is a direct benefit to our industry. So we're certainly all ears about helping where we can.
Let's get rid of this Carpophilus.
Yeah, if you can get rid of it, that's the way to go.
Again, this was just a portion of the Almond Journey podcast with Almond Board of Australia CEO Tim Jackson. You can listen to the entire podcast and other episodes by searching Almond Journey wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you, Brian. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. Now for more news. The flow of cattle into feedlots is continuing at high levels. Gary Crawford has more.
A record high number of cattle placed into feedlots in February. The USDA reporting placements at about 1.9 million head, up 10% from February a year ago. USDA livestock analyst Mike McConnell says most folks were not expecting that large of an increase, but consider this.
In January, we actually had a relatively low placement number. That was due to the winter storms that we had across the Midwest that came in early January, which delayed some of those placements. So some of the increase that we saw in placements during February was the fact that we were making up for some of the weather incidents that occurred during January.
Putting feedlot placements up at historical levels also, according to Mike.
Prices for feeder cattle are also very strong, but they're also at historic levels.
During February at Oklahoma City, prices for 750 to 800-pound cattle averaging 241 a hundredweight. It was only 184 during February last year, so obviously
there's a lot of opportunity for cow-calf operators to, you know, market their feeder cattle and, you know, get a good return on those animals that they're taking off pasture or taking off winter wheat pasture and placing them into feedlots. Now there's good returns for it. As you know, there's also still relatively robust demand for beef in the country.
But will consumer demand go down as beef prices continue to go up?
We're at the point in the season now where we're being a transition on the beef demand side towards the summer grilling season. So, you know, a lot about what we see happening in the cattle and beef markets in the next couple weeks and months are largely going to be predicated on how consumers respond, what kind of beef demand we get and how that works its way back through the system. So, yeah, so I think that's what we'll be paying attention to the next couple weeks and months as we prepare our forecast. And I imagine the market is going to be doing the same.
Mike is pretty sure about one forecast, and that is for continued contraction of the beef herd as producers keep selling heifers instead of holding on to them for breeding. And so
It's probably going to be at least another year or two down the line before we see the numbers start to indicate expansion.
This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
How has the COVID-19 pandemic impacted retail sales of organic food products over time? Rod Bain reports.
The organic food sector in our nation experienced significant growth over the past two decades. Yet that market was impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. As USDA research economist Sharon Skorbianski noted at this year's Ag Outlook Forum, after reaching record sales levels in 2020, in the following year,
the organic market experienced the first ever decline in organic retail sales, falling by 3%. And then in 2022, the last year for which we have organic trade association data, we saw an additional decline by 3.5%.
She says the decline in inflation-adjusted sales of organic products in 2022 was not surprising.
In 2022, the United States experienced the highest food price inflation since 1978. Food price inflation was 9.9%. So organic products typically have a price premium over conventional products, and it can be challenging for consumers to purchase organics with tightening budgets and with increasing food prices.
Despite that,
2022 sales are higher than those pre-pandemic, showing that while they were impacted, demand is still strong.
Now, what about sales of organic food products by category?
Organic fruits and vegetables are still the most popular category, making up 35% of the market and almost reaching $23 billion in 2022. Dairy and eggs is the second most popular category, and it surpassed $8 billion in 2022.
What area of the organic sector that continues to expand over time? Where organic food products are sold.
The progression of organic from being a really niche market, mainly sold at natural and health food stores from the 1970s up until the 2000s. But then as demand for organic grew and production of organic grew, found increased market access into traditional grocery stores and club stores. By the 2000s, these conventional grocery retailers became the most popular outlet for organic foods. And in 2022, 56% of organic foods were sold via these conventional groceries.
Also expanding in recent years, direct sales of organic products via the internet, with 7% of all 2022 organic food product sales occurring online. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet NewsHour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.